Oh, man, we got a lot of ground to cover this week, so I'll go fast. Hi, it's John Williams, and thank you again for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. Remember, you can always email us. Just email johnwilliams@wgnradio.com. Give us a good rating if you can, and please spread the news about the Mincing Rascals. Share it with your friends. We start in Trump land this week. How could we not? We'll go to Springfield, too, with a brief stop in Mars. We also talk at some length about the situation at Lincoln Park High School. That's a strange story. By the way, we do read your emails on this podcast. Not all of them, but we sure appreciate your thoughts. And at the end, we read the good ones. Okay, here we go. Today is Thursday. It's February 6th, 2020. It's 12:43 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals. It's the podcast we record at the studios at WGN Radio. You can hear me weekdays from noon to 3.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Newsroom. I also have the shortest title among the clients.
I'm Austin Berg, Vice
clients,
President of
Mars. Panelists. Whatever.
I'm Austin Berg, Chief Client of The Mincing Rascals and Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon, the managing editor and City Hall reporter for the Daily Line.
I'm Eric Zorn, the fully hinged columnist for the Tribune. I go in 3 times a week in the newspaper.
So usually Eric's introductions run longer than President Trump's celebratory speeches.
His post-impeachment survival talk, it wasn't a speech, it wasn't a press conference, was the strangest damn thing we've ever broadcast on this radio station.
It was really probably, three or four minutes about the impeachment.
He was talking about Steve Scalise and how the cops saved him. He was just
more strange how his wife loved him.
I missed that part.
Oh, you missed that. So he goes, Scalise, we go to see him that night, and his wife is broken up. She's heartbroken about this. He goes, you know, a lot of wives, they don't really care that much, but she really loved her husband.
I like to think that my wife would come to the hospital at least to pass by, maybe bring some flowers or something on her way to the book club or something. I don't know.
I was struck by the contrast with President Clinton's post-impeachment remarks after he had been acquitted. This was one of those sort of seminal moments in my political education, but, you know, it was in the Rose Garden, and he was
surrounded by members of the House, right? Democratic members.
And Al Gore was standing next to him, and Al Gore introduced him and said, you know, one day President Clinton will be remembered as one of the greatest presidents of our time, and I just sort of winced. And, you know, then President Clinton came to the microphone and was, you know, clearly humiliated by the whole thing.
What I want the American people to know, what I want the Congress to know, is that I am profoundly sorry for all I have done wrong in words and deeds. I never should have misled the country, the Congress, my friends, or my family. Quite simply, I gave in to my shame.
You know, I'm sorry, I'll do better. I have conferred with my God and my wife and my children. You know what I mean? It was just a different tone entirely. And, you know, it's one of those events that I feel like my daughters are going to hear on the radio at some point, because, of course, they're avid listeners to WGN. And I'm going to have a hard time explaining sort of what happened.
Explaining what?
Just why he was so angry.
You're speaking out about the impeachment,
Trump
about
today,
the,
yeah,
the
right.
talk.
Today, yeah.
You're not worried about the word that they heard, but rather just the whole...
Yeah. I mean, thing. I doubt that will be in the clips that they would hear. I imagine that my fellow journalists will edit that out in the sound bites that they share.
That was a live call for us today, Heather.
Yeah.
So the president is giving a speech. At one point, he talked himself into an angry lather, and he said the word bullshit. And my producer hit the delay button because she felt editorially she wasn't in a position to make the call on that. She erred on the side of caution.
And she didn't have time to do a lot of thinking.
Right. You hear bullshit, and you go, boom, hit the button. And then I said, no.
Just that's... like she did right now.
Podcasts have different licenses.
Bleep.
Although she didn't want to make that judgment call, she erred on the side of caution. I understand that. And then I felt that if it's the president's utterance, I almost can't imagine anything he would say that the American people should not hear, be it good or bad.
He said it in a lot of rallies before. I mean, he's been calling that.
Right.
Well,
This is in the East Room of the White House, his post-impeachment. I mean, it just was a weird thing. But I agree with you, John. I think anything he says, I'm not going to use the word, but the word he used on the bus, you know, about groping women. We all bleeped out that word, and... Yeah, I've said this before. That might have had an impact on the election.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can see bleeping that word out because he wasn't saying it as an official pronouncement from the East Room of the White House or at a rally.
But it protected him.
Yes.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
isn't it the old journalism cliche that you don't use swear words unless it's the Pope? I mean, isn't this the equivalent of the Pope?
I believe I wasn't around when the Tribune published a great hunk of excerpts from the Watergate tapes, but I think we used all the expletives that President Nixon used in our pages, and this was considered to be somewhat radical.
Long time ago, too.
Even I wasn't at the Tribune.
But if the Pope tears one off, you got to go with it.
Right.
Is that what
That's
you're saying?
The theory.
I didn't know that. Yeah, I would say the president is the political moral equivalent of that.
He only does that when he's trying to build furniture from IKEA.
Yeah. Or if you're building furniture from IKEA, then anybody gets to say
Or if
say
he gets
that.
Yanked by somebody in the crowd.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That'd be nice if they had a hot mic on the Pope and that woman grabbed him on the rope line and if he just laid into her in German something that we don't understand.
We have a Latin one now. The Germans retired. They're together in a movie, but...
Thank you for that. Yeah. The president did have a weird day. He was also at the National Prayer Breakfast today and began airing his grievances.
Our great country and your president have been put through a terrible ordeal by some very dishonest and corrupt people. They have done everything possible to destroy us. They know what they are doing is wrong. I don't like people who use their faith as justification for doing what they know is wrong.
I am very impressed with Mitt Romney, and he has not had a career of consistent moral rectitude. He has flip-flopped on a lot of issues. I had a lot of problems with Mitt Romney. I was really moved by his speech yesterday, by his assertion like, well, you know what? This is my conscience. I've got to live with this. I took an oath to do impartial justice. The president clearly solicited foreign involvement in our election. That's clearly wrong. He clearly did it. He's guilty of that. And he knew there was going to be a ton of blowback. There was a good interview he did with the New York Times before this, talking about how he knew that this was going to be a real mark on him and that he was going to take a lot of heat for it, but he did it anyway. So
Wait a minute, a real mark on him for voting to impeach?
Oh, yeah.
He's to remove. Yeah.
Right.
He voted guilty. And he knew. I mean, if it would come down to his vote only, it would have been really consequential. This was utterly inconsequential in terms of what happened.
He gets to have his cake and eat it. He gets to take the high road and not feel like he kicked the president out.
No, but he's going to suffer from it.
How?
There's going to be huge backlash.
Well, you can tell my politics on this. I think he has the luxury of being what?
Not among Republicans.
Is he not the only person then to ever vote to remove a president of his party? Nobody has ever crossed the line,
right? And I would voted. I highly recommend listening to that. The Daily, the New York Times podcast, aired that interview that they did with him the Wednesday morning before the vote, and it's just the reporter and him talking. It's fascinating.
But it was embargoed in that they told him how, or he told them how he was going to vote.
Oh, yeah. No kidding.
He gave one to Chris Wallace too, I think.
Right.
He describes waiting and watching Romney actually speak. He says you don't want to push the button on a story like that until you're sure that he hasn't changed his mind.
Yeah.
And I think what was really interesting about him speaking there and the point that the New York Times reporter made was Romney has a history of political opportunism, and will his legacy be that if not for this big grand gesture at the end of his tenure?
When you swear an oath before God to apply impartial justice, mm-hmm. that's what I believe I have to do.
Yeah. And I think that's actually a pretty compelling argument.
I will
also note that I was the only Mincing Rascal to correctly guess one Republican vote to remove.
I was going
to
say we need to hold ourselves accountable.
I was probably out of the room by then.
I don't even remember that, but I'm glad that you did.
I'm simply going to deny it.
Here's my favorite thing. So you talk about repercussions. Donald Trump Jr. then tweets out almost immediately that
Mitt Romney is
whatever he is and that he should be kicked out of the party.
He called him a pussy.
Oh, he did? No, I didn't know that part.
He tweeted that.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Hello.
Okay. Well, so wait. Let's walk through kicking him out of the party because he's a U.S. senator for another 4 years or so, right? It's a narrowly divided Senate. So the Republicans kick Mitt Romney out, and he is going to align with the Democrats?
Well, there are independents in the Senate.
That's
Angus
what I mean.
King.
So that's right? What I'm saying. You kick him out, and you give the Democrats another vote in the Senate. That's not really thinking things through.
I don't think that he's going to vote as a Democrat. In fact, he was pretty clear in this New York Times interview that his principles have not changed. His politics haven't changed. And he said that he believed in a lot of what the president has done policy-wise. He felt that he really committed this crime that he was charged with. And that, and you know, I have to really respect that.
I was struck by him saying that he believed that his children and grandchildren would suffer the consequences for it. And that took my breath away.
In Utah, you know, he's going to remember more like Margaret Chase Smith, the woman who was one of the first senators who came out against Joe McCarthy. I think he's going to be remembered that way, not as some sort of Judas. In, even in 4 years, if he runs again, and he's not up again until 2004, I believe
2024.
I'm sorry, 2024.
We can't go backwards, Eric. We can't.
That this may not be an issue by then. That
He's in Utah too, I think he can do whatever he wants.
So,
and his city's safe. Unlike Doug Jones, I mean, you think Doug Jones is even going to campaign in Alabama
or Joe Manchin?
Manchin's a little more popular than Jones, but yeah,
sure. And Kristen Sinema in Arizona, she's got a tough re-election.
Arizona only went for Trump by 4 percentage points. I think Kristen Sinema really had no choice. I think if she had voted for Trump and she had voted to quit him, she would have been a bigger problem for her. Doug Jones is in a no-win situation. I was talking to our friend.
We should just say Jones won in a special election to replace Jeff Sessions,
right,
and beat Roy Moore, who was, let's say, not a formidable candidate. But,
right.
And Sessions is running again for his old seat. Right?
Right. And I was talking to our friend Scott Standis, who's now living down in Alabama. And I was asking about this.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
Former rascal.
And he said, you know, no matter what Jones says, he's not going to win down there in all likelihood. It's a deeply red state. So
you guys got to go back to the Romney consequences thing, though. It just seems to me like he was in the perfect position to take, for history's sake, heck, for 20 minutes from now's sake, the right vote.
What happens to anyone who crosses the president?
He starts
tweeting against them. He rails against them. He singles them out. He did it today at the prayer breakfast, right?
Correct.
And you've got his followers who do that. His son calls him apparently pieces of the anatomy. I mean, so and within the Republican Party, there is damage for him to be done. I'm sure he's being threatened as well.
Isn't there a possibility that the president orders the FBI to investigate Romney
family? You guys.
Benjamin Witte's of the blog Lawfare, which has done a lot on this, but isn't that something that has to cross your mind as Senator Romney?
No, doesn't cross my mind at all.
Have you not been watching?
John, it just could be that everything that he does in the Senate, every initiative he has, every bill he wants to propose, that his caucus turns their back on him, that they don't invite him to the Republican lunches. I mean, it could be a pretty miserable 4 years
for him. He already got disinvited from CPAC, the big conservative political action.
Seriously.
Disinvited, but he had never actually been invited, and he said he hasn't been for like 8 years.
Okay, but this is evidence.
It's not a fun party. It's not something anyone should want to go to. Yeah.
But then this is evidence that the Republican Party is not the Republican Party anymore, because he's a Republican. And this is just the cult of Donald Trump, and that's the mistake he's made. I guess that's apparent here, isn't it? He's crossed Trump, but he's still a good Republican. He could still be a Republican and vote with them. They should still count on his vote, except for this one exception, where he voted his conscience.
Based on my reporting, which is basically watching cable news television shows.
So you're an expert, is what you're saying.
Trump spoke on Thursday, but there was an event where they thought he was going to do his victory speech on Wednesday after the vote in the Senate, but they were kind of floored by the Romney vote, and they were really disappointed that they didn't get like a Jones vote or a Manchin vote. They thought things were going to go better for them than
Pence
they did.
Pence told a TV interviewer, "We expect the president to be acquitted on a bipartisan basis," and that didn't happen.
Didn't happen. No,
no Democrats crossed over. What did you guys make of the Nancy Pelosi script tearing and the President Trump, Nancy Pelosi non-handshake? Austin, you go first.
It plays into Trump's hands. I mean, it's all so theatrical, right? And then there's a million tweets afterwards about Nancy was ripping up the paper beforehand throughout the speech to make it easier to rip. And I think at the end of the day, if that game is going to be played, I think the president wins that game like 10 times out of 10. I was just thinking about, did any of you guys watch the Super Bowl interview with him? Which is a weird tradition. Like that
Obama
we do this
started
now.
It,
yeah, it's really odd. But
is that true, Obama started it?
Yeah. Okay.
It's overly patriotic or something. Something's creepy about
it. This time with Sean Hannity.
Yeah, this time with Hannity. And Hannity basically made him do word association with each of the Democratic candidates.
I'm just going to throw out a name. We'll start with Joe Biden. And just think of Sleepy. He's Sleepy, Sleepy Joe.
Hunter Biden.
He made millions of dollars. He went from having no job, no income. This is crooked as hell.
Bernie Sanders.
Well, I think he's a communist. I mean, you know, look.
Elizabeth Warren.
At least he's true to what he believes. That's one thing. Because you mentioned now Elizabeth Warren. She's not true to it. I call it a fairy tale. Because everything's a fairy tale. That's how Pocahontas got started.
And line by line, he's just dismissing them. But it showed what he's very, very good at, which is this kind of reality television antics. He brands each of these candidates so – it's so sticky, the descriptors he uses of each of them. And I don't know if fighting back by doing that sort of big paper terror is a good or bad thing. Ultimately, I don't care. But I don't know if it's a good move.
I ultimately think that it is a very rare instance of a powerful woman getting angry in public.
So she wasn't planning it.
I just think that we are socialized as women, and especially as women with power, to never show anger. And that she did, and that it clearly frustrated and angered the president.
Did it, though?
I mean, he tweeted like crazy about it.
Okay. Well, that's because she made a mistake and did it, and she gave him that fuel.
I don't know whether it was a mistake or not. It's certainly not behavior that I would like to see from my daughters in public, but it is something to be said that it was a very public demonstration of anger by a powerful woman, and there is nothing, there are few things more regulated than that.
That's an interesting point, because my wife and I were texting back and forth this morning as the president was giving his speech, his talk after the impeachment. And I said, imagine if this was Hillary, how they would have labeled and criticized and judged her sanity and just say she's off the chain. Donald Trump. Actually, if Barack Obama did that, if Mitt Romney did that, if anybody but
Ripped
Donald Trump
the
does
speech?
That. No, well, now I've segued back to just how we judge people and who gets to do what. Trump gets to do anything. But I take your point, Heather.
I mean, this is a speech where he gives the Presidential Medal of Freedom to a repulsive talk show host who is, arguably patient zero of the kind of polarization, the media polarization that we're in right now, in the middle of this speech, and he doesn't shake her hand at the beginning of the speech, and I just feel like Republicans who are all wrapped around the axle about this just don't have any standing. Their president is this profane, blundering narcissist, and so they're pretending to be all upset about her tearing the pages of this speech when he tears up the Constitution.
Well, nobody should make a decorum argument about it. Yeah, I totally agree.
She was flying those papers around, because I noticed that during the speech. I'm like, that's weird. She keeps picking up the papers and putting them down.
Well, she's putting them into rippable stacks.
So I think she was foreshadowing, like, look, I'm looking at the speech. When I rip something, here's this. I really do think that. So I think it was calculated and a mistake.
Yeah, agreed on that.
What does Michelle say when they aim low, aim high? Or, and
how's that working out?
When they go low, we go high.
Right.
So Adam Sewer of The Atlantic, who I believe will eventually win the Pulitzer for criticism, and he was the person who said that the cruelty of Donald Trump was the point, that essentially he's not cruel by mistake or, inadvertently, that is entirely the point. And he had a very well-written essay, I thought, in December that argued that this civility policing, this decorum policing, is another tool of enforcing norms that do not allow women and people of color and people who are not straight to fully express who they are as white men are allowed to express. That essay made me think differently about these sort of flare-ups, that the president is allowed to call people names and sort of, act beyond what we would consider acceptable behavior. But when a woman or a person of color does that, they are far more harshly criticized.
Maybe more harshly criticized, Heather, but if another, I was going to say Barack Obama, of course, who's not a white man, but if any other politician or someone in power speaks the way Donald Trump does, I think they would be called out too. I just think Trump has this Teflon about him.
He gets called out, doesn't he, Steve? I mean,
yeah,
so he does it, but listen to us. But the point is, he gets away with it. That is, that room today, a couple hundred people sitting in the east wing of the White House. And I thought, I wondered if these people are starting to regret being in the room. But they were still laughing at his jokes and applauding his awful digs. And I thought, the thing about Trump isn't that he says it, it's that he gets away with it.
Well, because there's a sense, that he can't be shamed. right? He can't. He's not going to lose sleep about that last night. But we all have the sense that maybe Nancy Pelosi is somehow would be troubled by this criticism. And that gives that criticism sort of life because, again, women and particularly powerful women, and she is the most powerful woman in the United States, who are socialized to make other people comfortable. And ripping up the president's speech, however you cut it, was not designed to make him comfortable.
So do you think it would have been more acceptable to all of us if John Boehner had done that than Nancy Pelosi?
I think that you have to compare what Nancy Pelosi did with Joe Wilson, the former congressman from South Carolina, who yelled out, "You lie," to President Obama.
The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally. Not true.
I sort of see those as equivalent State of the Union
actions.
Well,
he was condemned for that.
Was he, though?
Oh, I think he was.
I mean, he was...
He was condemned for it, but he also raised a ton of money off
yes.
it.
Yes.
Okay. Well, who's to say Nancy won't?
Yeah, she's...
I wanted to allude to a tweet that Austin sent me this week, and I can't remember the exact wording of it, but it said something like...
I can't believe you guys talk when we're not here.
I'm offended.
I never heard from any of you.
I wasn't in that loop.
It's just me and Austin, as we do. And he said the tweet is something like, the State of the Union is the best example ever of a meeting that should have been an email. and it plays into my belief that this is a tradition that we should just—it needs to stop.
Was that a retweet or was that an original?
No, that wasn't me. That was sending someone else's tweet. But that's why
he sent it along.
Yeah, the decorum, like. I think the whole State of the Union decorum should be it's silly. I think the whole thing is theatrical, and I don't respect it whatsoever. But I don't think that's why what Nancy Pelosi did may be good or bad. I don't think it should be based on like, oh, she violated the decorum of the moment.
No matter who's president, you've got this situation where you've got these people in the audience, and Trump had he did this reality TV thing where the soldier walks down the aisle and he hugs the wife, and it's just like it's a TV show for him. And then you've got the Democrats sitting there stoned. Face, you've got the Republicans chanting four more years.
The Democrats aren't just stone faced. The Democratic women are also wearing T-shirts.
What? No,
white T-shirts.
No, they were wearing white. Some of them were wearing T-shirts, but most of them were wearing suffragette white.
Okay. I just think, it's like.
But this is no different than what they.
It's just getting worse and worse, is what I'm saying.
I mean, Ronald Reagan started with the guests, but he would just point out someone in the audience. This idea of a member of the military surprising his family. Being manipulated.
I want to bring a big one of those big checks that they have.
Right.
Publisher's clearinghouse check.
I mean, it's like they ought to. I mean, I was kind of hoping last year that Nancy Pelosi, remember, she didn't invite him to the White House, to Congress to give the speech. It has to be done. She has to invite him. And she was waiting while the government was shut down. And I was thinking, please just don't do it this year. Don't invite him. There's nothing in the Constitution that says he's got to give a speech. In fact, it was a tradition, up to about 100 years ago, where that they just give a written account to Congress of the State of the Union. And now it's turned into a campaign speech, especially during an election year.
Austin, though, wouldn't that be then they go low, we go high? I mean, should we take Eric's advice and get rid of it completely? Not even if you don't invite him, I think that's just playing into Donald Trump as victim, and he parlays that very well.
Yeah, I think you kind of have to have acquiescence from both sides to do it. Properly, you'd have to say, which is this is never going to happen. But I think the point is, in the context of a dog and pony show, analyzing everyone's individual dog and pony tricks is not that productive.
In the past, they'd show a video of it look like someone Hillary Clinton sleeping or someone making a grimace. And that was always an issue during these as well. I think, which is maybe an example of what you're talking about.
And I don't disagree. Like, I'm sure women's behavior in that context is probably way more scrutinized. But I think. I would prefer we just don't have it at all.
Do you think that her extending her hand to him for the handshake when he handed her the speech, Trump to Pelosi, was her setting the trap?
The video's not. If this were an NFL replay.
Oh, this is the Zapruder film of handshakes, but I'm telling you.
It might have come a little too late.
I think she knew full well he wasn't going to shake it. And she stuck it out there almost as a taunt.
And how are you blaming her for this?
I wasn't going to say it. I wasn't going to say it.
This is very.
I thought it was a trap.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's not a blame though. That's a maneuver.
She's stuck out her hand so he could shake it. And you're calling this a maneuver?
But the other side is quick to point out that he didn't shake the vice president's hand.
Well,
either.
Who would?
He's from Indiana.
Did he
after
extend
all?
His hand?
He did not. No.
No. Trump just handed the speeches and turned. He didn't want to have anything to do with that. And then I think Nancy knew full well that's how it was going to go.
There were the pictures this morning of Obama shaking John Boehner's hand. It's like, oh, look, Obama did it.
There's also pictures out today, though. There's a meme. It's a window pane, four windows squares, and it shows Obama giving the Presidential Medal of Freedom to two people who didn't get it. One was Harvey Weinstein, and the other is Anthony Weiner. And it's like, well, if you want to be critical of the one, you have to be critical of the other. Of course, that didn't happen. If you had to decide, Eric, would you give the Medal of Freedom to Rush Limbaugh? I guess I know your answer.
And I wouldn't give it to Rachel Maddow either.
Well, that's the point, though. Let me rephrase the question to you. It is within the president's prerogative to pick whoever he wants,
sure.
Right? It's like saying, do you like chocolate ice cream or strawberry ice cream? It's who he favors, and he gets to do whatever he wants with it, right? If he diminishes the brand a little bit, say Levee, it's his call to give it to whomever he wants. Bill Cosby has one.
That was back when Cosby was funny before he was caught. You know, I don't have a strong feeling about the Limbaugh thing, and I'm feeling like I'm wrong. but
you are. That's okay. Let it out, Steve.
If you do believe in the Limbaugh, and Limbaugh has been a consequential character in American politics for 25, 30 years. He has been.
Consequentially toxic.
Okay, but also someone who has championed the people who are in power right now. I mean, they believe in what he says. When they gave it to him, and he just announced he's likely dying of lung cancer, mm-hmm. I wasn't taken aback by that, I don't think. I mean, I suppose Rachel Maddow's not a good example. I don't know who a good liberal example would be, but if you had a liberal president giving to, say Eric Zorn is a columnist or something like that.
But there's no evidence that any other...
And I just equated you with Rush Limbaugh, and I'm sorry.
There's no evidence that any other president had used the Medal of Freedom as a way to reward supporters.
Yeah, Michael Moore.
That it has never before been used as, I'm giving this to my friends and supporters. You know, it was people like Rosa Parks and, you know...
If you look at the entire list, there are people who have been major donors to those presidents on the business side.
Interesting. Now, I didn't know that.
And maybe it's because they were also instrumental in the internet or in finance or something, but I don't think these things happen in a pure environment, right?
But it does. I think it really does cheapen the award, doesn't it? I mean, if it's going out to...
Well, I'm not going to accept mine.
To Rush, I know. Right now, I'm telling you, right now, if he offers one to me, I will decline.
That's why the next president should do this. Get away with the State of the Union address. Get away with the Presidential Medal of Freedom or give away fewer. You know, just sort of distance yourselves from all of the trappings that you feel that Trump has colored in a way that you're not comfortable. It's sort of like when a new family moves into a house, even the White House, you paint the walls a different color. So maybe the next family that comes in should say, okay, we're going to do things completely different.
Well, I'm sorry, John.
That's the end of that.
We're going to have press briefings.
Any family in the United States who were to move in next would do things differently. This is a unique animal. The next president, whether he's a Republican or she's a Democrat or whatever, is not going to behave this way.
But that's why I'm not so worried, say, about the brand of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, because there's always going to be an asterisk by every paint color on the wall and thing Donald Trump has done. Maybe these institutions will still retain their value, if you will, and then we'll just remember that there was this one time when.
Sort of like an asterisk of the steroid era of the baseball
He's
Hall of
the Mark
Fame.
McGuire of presidents.
I think history is going to prove us wrong on this, right? Because every time executive power is expanded, it's very, very difficult to put it back in the box, and that applies to the way they communicate and to, you know, the way that they use their office.
You know, this is something that...
So we're not going to go back to normal.
I don't think so.
So that has occurred to me because Lori Lightfoot does not tweet the same way that Rahm Emanuel does. And this is probably something that I should write about, you know, for my job that pays me money. But, you know, the way she uses Twitter is very different than the way Rahm Emanuel used it. And there has to be influence of Trump on that. And I don't really know how to parse that, and how that's either helping her or hurting her isn't clear to me yet. But I think that proves Austin's point.
Are we going to go to Iowa?
We will, but I just wanted you to say, describe how she uses Twitter.
Well, she is not afraid to take pointed shots at people. Like, you know, after the impeachment vote or the removal vote, she said it was a dark day for the country. That's not something that we had seen from Rahm Emanuel's Twitter account. His Twitter account was, apply for these grants, or here I am dancing the samba with right. Chicago's greatest samba dancer type, very sort of anodyne, something that I didn't have to pay attention to. I pay far more attention to the mayor's tweets now because there's always the possibility that she's going to make real news in a way that Rahm Emanuel did not.
So did Iowa completely screw it up, or are we being too critical on Iowa?
I want to bring Iowa up because I just got a news alert that Andrew Yang has fired dozens of staffers after doing so badly. In fact, two more than people who caucus for him, apparently. No. But he finished with 1%. I guess he's staying in the race, but has fired a bunch of people to try to reorganize.
Well, and a couple hours ago, they announced that the Democratic Party would re-canvass the votes in Iowa.
The National Party wants them
right.
to, yeah.
Well, I don't quite understand why they would do that, because as soon as the New Hampshire primary results are in, people are going to forget about Iowa.
Right.
And we know the rough outlines of Iowa. We know that Buttigieg and Sanders tied, right? I mean, more or less. It's like it's a statistical blip between the two of them.
0.15%.
Something like that. I mean, they're tied, and then Biden did poorly, and Elizabeth Warren struggled, and Amy Klobuchar, I think, is still in it.
That's
barely.
Your big five.
She's hanging on by her fingernails. But that's it. That's the news out of Iowa. And no matter how much they re-canvass it, that's what
right.
they may change a couple percent. Why would they bother to do
what
that?
What Iowa's about is the speech that night. You know, that
right.
you know, that to propel you on
to New Hampshire,
right? Yeah. But and Buttigieg and Sanders were robbed of that, and that's why they were working there for 3 years. You know, to get the momentum into the upcoming primaries, and they screwed that up.
Do you guys
and that's
know
too
what
bad.
So what is the relationship between winning Iowa and winning the nomination or winning the
election? Clinton didn't
so
win
it's
either.
Seven out
Ask
of nine. Well, Hillary Clinton won Iowa.
And Tom Harkin was running when Bill Clinton ran. So
it was considered it was a non-event that year.
And Paul Tsongas was running in New Hampshire when Bill Clinton ran.
Right.
So what's the answer to my question?
Yeah, I think he did.
Is there a relationship?
It depends. So the problem is that if you cast your memory back all the way to the 2012 Republican Iowa caucus, originally Mitt Romney was announced as the winner of the caucus. It turned out a couple days later that Santorum had won by 8 votes. So this is not an unprecedented situation. Iowa has not done a great job counting votes for a long time. So this is not some new issue.
But I think if you look at the Democrats, the Democratic winner is much more likely to go on to the nomination than the Republican winner.
But was that when Iowa was a blue state? And I don't think you can call Iowa a blue state anymore. I think that its relevance to the Democratic Party is changing because it is disproportionately white and rural.
So Buttigieg did get the win speech. He called it.
At 11:30,
and
yeah.
I think why it matters still, and I think why this might not matter on whether they should re-canvass or not, but Sanders people are so distrustful of the institution of the Democratic Party already.
Gosh, why?
And this really, really is going to rile them up. The fact that this has been so bungled, seemingly against their candidate, whoever the nominee is going to need a lot of those people to support them, and that's why I think it's a problem.
Do you think it helps him in a sort of perverse way,
no,
Bernie?
No, I don't, because I think it turns a lot of the other candidates' supporters kind of against him because of the way his supporters have reacted and saying it, basically everybody's corrupt, screw Warren, screw Biden. So it really hurts the Democratic Party, period, I think, for that reason.
Eric, weren't you like a victim of the Bernie bros last time?
You know, I've blocked it out if I was.
What's the Bernie bros?
Well, I mean, I believed then and I believe now. I mean, I admire a lot of what Bernie Sanders stands for, not all of it, but I admire a lot of it. But I also strongly believe that it's going to be a extremely heavy lift politically for a self-identified socialist from Vermont who's now nearly 80 years old.
And has had a heart attack.
And has had a heart attack to win the presidency. And Bernie Sanders has never really had anybody campaign strongly against him. There is an oppo file on him, you know, 6 feet thick that the Republicans are just waiting to open up. And you can see in some of this Republican commentary where they're trying to nurse this grievance on the part of Sanders supporters.
Well, Trump in the Super Bowl interview said they're rigging it against him again.
Yeah, they're trying to build up Sanders because they know that Sanders has never been tested politically, and Sanders will get.
And Trump wants Bernie to win. Right?
Sanders
right.
will make George McGovern look like the greatest idea of the Democrats ever had.
I would just suggest that the track record of opposition parties wanting to pick their opponents has not been great. Because let's not forget that the Democratic National Party thought, let's boost Trump; he will be easier to beat in a general election. So
but this is about depressing support for if it's not Bernie, right? Because you say, hey, look, these guys rigged it against your guy, why would you ever go vote?
Then fewer people show up, period.
Yeah. If I had Bernie Sanders, you know, sitting in front of me, I don't know that I've ever heard him fully grapple with the fact that the Russian interference exacerbated that tension, that they exploited that opening, that his supporters happened. And I don't know how much he's responsible for it, but I've never really heard him grapple with that.
Should the Democrats just concede now? Because, I mean, we don't think Bernie Sanders has much of a shot. You know, I watched the CNN roundtable or public, whatever those things are, with Joe Biden last night. I love Joe Biden. I saw Joe Biden speak when I was in college 35 years ago, and I wanted him to be the nominee running away, and I don't think he has it now. I don't know that the country, I think the country will not vote for a married gay man. I just don't.
And did you see that viral video of the Buttigieg supporter going to caucus for
him? Try to return the vote?
And discover that he's married to a man and just get into it with one of his precincts campaigns.
So are you saying that he has a same-sex partner? Yes. Are you kidding?
Yeah, he's married to him, yeah.
We need to find out if that's serious.
Well, then I don't want anybody like that in the White House. So can I have my card back? I don't know. Yeah. Find it. We could go ask.
Live on camera.
And then he said, well, he kept it a secret. It's like, well, no, he hasn't kept it.
Well, he doesn't announce it every day.
I also worry about the fact that Buttigieg has only run a relatively small city in Indiana, and he has his executive experience. Although Trump had absolutely no executive experience.
Well, you know, and so. I don't know why, Eric, that Buttigieg refers to himself as a mayor of South Bend, why he doesn't refer to himself more as a combat veteran. You know, because there are a lot of...
I don't know that he can claim a combat veteran status.
But he did tours in Afghanistan.
Sure. My brother's a Marine. He's very particular about this sort of thing. Like, whether you're in combat is a very specific
designation. Okay, veteran who served terms overseas. Yeah. Because, I mean, that got a lot of people elected around the country to Congress, and that helps, too.
John Kerry, unfortunately.
It never comes up, you know, in the first or second sentence about Buttigieg, and I think... The Democrats haven't been talking much about foreign policy anyway, but I don't know why they don't use that more.
I saw a heat map of which counties or precincts went with whom in the Iowa caucus, and I don't know that I know Iowa that well, but Mayor Pete did really well in the outlying areas.
Well, he did. He was basically the only candidate who was organized in the
rural. I guess that's
candidate.
What it demonstrated, because yes. I don't know what Iowans are like, but I was a little surprised to see them embrace a gay man that way, but clearly they did compared to the other candidates.
I thought that maybe one of the big winners on Monday night was Bloomberg. That with Biden dropping so precipitously, and with Klobuchar did, I think, well enough to hang in there. But who's Buttigieg, is he going to occupy that moderate lane? Is he going to be the one the party's going to go for? Or is there going to be a hunger and an opening when it comes to Super Tuesday for voters who've seen millions and millions of dollars worth of Bloomberg ads and say, you know, let's give this guy a chance. He makes a good point in his ads. I mean, right. And it could be that the strategy of ignoring New Hampshire and Iowa has never proved to work very well, but I think that it could work this time.
Okay, let's do this. We'll wrap this up. But we're leaving Iowa now, and they'll go on to New Hampshire. Well, I'm going to ask you guys the following question, though, and that is, who has the best chance among the Democrats of beating the incumbent? Who has the best chance among the Democrats of winning?
So there's a interesting new political scientist who I've begun following on Twitter, Rachel Bitecoffer, who's profiled in Politico magazine today. And her argument is that essentially whomever the Democrats put up stands a better than 50% chance of beating Donald Trump because the way the electorate is likely to be constituted in November.
So any Democrat will win.
That's her argument.
So who's got the best chance, do you think?
That's the question.
I think New Hampshire will be more important this year than it has been in past years because of the Iowa debacle.
This is a short answer question. You have the best chance of winning the
election. I don't know.
Eric Zorn,
no, the question is best chance of beating the incumbent. That's
yes,
the question.
Yes.
I have put my marker on Klobuchar, and I'm going to leave it there.
Well, that's where mine is, too.
That's funny because I'm going to say Warren because I don't consider Klobuchar a potential, but
well, that wasn't the question.
That was not the question. Who among them has the best chance of beating the?
Well, incumbent? I think Elizabeth Warren might.
Okay, how about you?
Like Warren, Klobuchar, Yang.
Okay,
Yang.
Thank you for that concise non-answer. You're evidently.
I'm rubbing off on my colleague
off on
over
the
here.
The person sitting to your right. By the way, the person to your right and Eric Zorn have been trading notes. This one from Eric Zorn to me says, "Hey, Austin is right. This is a total cluster bleep, and I find it hard to follow. They were talking about this last night on WTTW's roundtable, and I was making Scooby Doo noises the whole time." This is about the what you described as the bizarre saga of how Mike Madigan's office handled sexual harassment allegations. What are you guys talking about?
So, breaking Friday news, last Friday evening, Speaker Madigan's office, there's been a search warrant executed there in Springfield. That's a huge deal. That's the most powerful politician in the state. You have state police there executing a warrant. What was the warrant about? So they were seeking evidence related to potential sexual assault and battery of a former Democratic state representative named Jack Franks.
Of or by? You said...
He was the one who would have committed these crimes,
so
allegedly.
Committed by, okay.
Committed by Franks. Franks left the legislature in 2017. He now serves as the board chairman of the McHenry County Board. And he was a longtime Democratic lawmaker in Springfield. So a number of questions immediately arise, which is, when did Madigan know about any of these potential sexual harassment, sexual assault, battery claims? What does he know, and when did he know it? And so now people are kind of going back. Madigan had to basically come out into the media and establish a timeline of when different things happened. It essentially goes like this. I'll be quick. So in 2018, Madigan's office got evidence of sexual harassment claims going back as far as 2016 from Franks. In February 2019, that complaint was deemed credible, and then Franks was banned from the state house without an escort. This is a sitting lawmaker in Illinois, a board chairman who cannot go into Springfield without an escort because of fear of what he may do.
And all this is happening. We don't know. The public knows
nothing
about it. The public
knows zero about all of this. Then in March 2019, February is when he gets banned without an escort. March 2019, Madigan says he gets new information and goes to the Illinois State Police and tries to facilitate a meeting with the state police and the victim. Then cut to January 2020, police have a search warrant to go into Madigan's office. That's what we know. The big takeaway here, as Eric said, is all of this was being done to a prominent lawmaker by the speaker's office with nobody's knowledge, none of the voters' knowledge. And that's the problem, ultimately. I'll talk about a testimony we heard today from the Legislative Inspector General, Julie Porter, who said she had a credible report of serious wrongdoing in the General Assembly, and it was squelched by the Legislative Ethics Commission. That's the problem when you have lawmakers policing each other, is cases like this. You had someone who was a credible sexual harasser whose constituents didn't know about it.
This Franks guy, has he been convicted?
He has not.
He has not been charged. And he denies all of this.
Is he going to be charged?
We don't know. They're clearly investigating. There's a state police investigation.
And the clock's running 3 years on this now, right?
At least.
Four?
Yeah.
Well, it's 2016, so you know.
And we don't know when the potential criminal activity happened. It's possible that Madigan's office kind of gave him a slap on the wrist for some kind of a harassment complaint that is less serious than these battery or assault charges that are now being discussed.
And the other thing to note is that this is when the whole Me Too scandal is unspooling. This is not, I mean,
it didn't unspool in Springfield.
Well, though. No, I mean, we're talking just like a year ago, that this was all over the news. I can't remember when the Elena Hampton accusations and all that stuff was going around and swirling around Madigan, and how was he handling these things. So if it was only in 2016, you say, well, that's how it was handled back then. But a year ago, we were taking this more seriously. There was more proactivity. And now it's curious that they had to execute a search warrant in Madigan's office.
And imagine during all that firestorm that this happened in Madigan's office and nobody, it somehow didn't get out, right?
Well, and not only that, there's the strangeness with the Sangamon County District Attorney criticizing Madigan for releasing these documents to the Sun-Times after a Freedom of Information Act request. That county's that includes Springfield says these documents were private. They should not have been released under FOIA, which is another twist to this
whole
thing. The information that Franks is under investigation and had been banned from the Capitol without an escort.
The search warrant.
The search warrant, essentially.
Was Madigan, why are you so surprised that they're executing a warrant, though, searching Madigan's office? It seems like he's central to all of this, so it makes sense, right?
The surprise I think Heather is referring to is the fact that Madigan's office doesn't just release documents when people ask for them. Someone asked for the search warrant that day and got it, or the next week, very soon after. So the question is, why did he keep all of this information quiet before the warrant? And then as soon as the warrant hits, hey, everybody, we just got a warrant. And the district attorney says, you should not have released that. And the thought is, Madigan doesn't want a headline the next week that says his office was, quote, raided.
He certainly had enough leeway under the Freedom of Information Act request to comply with the Sun-Times request without immediately releasing these documents. And I think that's what the Sangamon County District Attorney is upset about. Essentially, he was like, you shouldn't have released these under FOIA at all, but you certainly shouldn't have done it without consulting with me, since I'm the investigating agency here.
What's the possible crime, or what's the worst wrongdoing that Madigan then is facing here? I mean, he was only knowledgeable about this and didn't say enough about it.
Well, I think that's the fundamental question. Is there another instance of a lawmaker or a high-ranking official, and correct me if you think I'm wrong here, Austin, did Madigan essentially sweep under the rug more sexual harassment claims? Because let's not forget, he lost Tim Brown.
Tim Mapes.
Yeah. So there is a lot going on that Madigan has had to answer for.
And it's odd to me that they had to execute a search warrant if Madigan was ostensibly cooperating with their investigation. And in fact, according to Austin's timeline, I'm trying to follow that he was the one who called some things to the attention of the state police. He's the one who wanted them to escort Jack Franks through the Capitol.
So the question would be, Madigan maybe said, hey, here's some evidence, and the state police says, okay, are you cooperating? Give us this. And they're like, no, we're good with this. And then they say,
even more conspiratorial, is it possible that they said, well, we don't want to just give you this because that might look bad, so can you just get a search warrant and come in and take it so that we don't have to get blamed for
it? Sure, but at the end of the day, it's lawmakers policing lawmakers. That's a huge problem. If only your friendly neighborhood think tank had a bill that would fix this exact thing.
Let's go to Austin Byrd right with the suggestion.
So I'm going to get into my earpiece. It's House Bill 4558.
Filed yesterday.
4558. Chief sponsor is Democrat Jonathan Carroll out of the Northwest Suburbs. It would empower the legislative inspector general to be able to release reports of wrongdoing instead of having to go ask other lawmakers whether or not they can release it.
Doesn't it seem like Mike Madigan lives on Mars and he's on another solar system?
Madigan is from Mars. Harmon is from Venus. Is that what we're
so
going with
here? Unreachable, and you have to divine what's going on or what he means. He's this mysterious, quiet power player who lives right over there and spends time here and there where there are reporters in either location. I've never understood
obsequiousness or something?
Well, he does live, I think what you're saying is that he lives in sort of his own atmosphere. The rules that other state officials are subject to do not address him. Even the governor is forced to answer reporters' questions more frequently than Madigan is.
Yeah,
and political gravity does not apply to him. He manages to hang on to his speakership and, of course, his seat in the General Assembly without being the kind of person who goes out and glad hands or goes on Chicago Tonight and gives interviews or answers Elif Garris's call beyond John Williams' radio show.
Well, but that's the thing. I mean, that's the thing, that most politicians eventually have to answer to one of us, and it seems like I've asked the gang this before. When's the last time anybody in this room interviewed Mike Madigan?
I'll say never, John.
I mean, he answered questions in the Capitol earlier this week in like a press gaggle, so I think that counts to some extent.
I guess.
I mean, is he welcome to come sit down with the Daily Line whenever he would like? Certainly. Is he ever going to do that? I'm not holding my breath.
No, but I mean, don't you feel that there's at some point some obligation? You know, that Barack Obama should go on Fox News, or that Donald Trump should go on CNN or my show, or that the Speaker of the House should come on, sit down with some regularity with an Eric Zorn, for instance. To me, that that should be part and parcel of the job.
I'll clear my schedule for him.
If you want to get into the psychology of him and people like Burke as well, a great book is called Don't Make No Waves, Don't Back No Losers. And it's by a professor named Milton Rakoff. It was written in the 70s. And the key point is that's essentially the tagline of the Daily Machine. Don't make no waves, meaning don't ever make a controversial decision that gets headlines because the people who hate it will come out and vote against
you. He's good at that, right?
He has been for 30 years, and now he's being not so good at it.
Speaking of that, here's a text that poured into my show the other day. It said, "Hey, John, tell Austin SIU Press says hello. We published his book. He sounds great with the Mincing Rascals."
Holy moly.
Here's another.
Who is that, Sylvia?
It's from 618.
From SIU Press. Thank
and
you.
This came from James, an email to the Mincing Rascals. It says, "Mr. Williams, the Mincing Rascals is a terrific podcast, and my wife and I eagerly look forward to listening to it early Friday morning. I have one suggestion for you. I suggest that you bring back Kristen McQuarrie to the podcast. We will invite her once in a while, but Kristen's schedule does not allow her to regularly appear in the gaggle here, but we know her, we love her, we miss her. And dear John, I've been listening to your Mincing Rascals podcast every week for the past few months, and I simply wanted to relay my appreciation. We here are juggling a lot of stuff right now, and a few hours ago, looking for some quiet time, I remembered that I had not yet listened to your podcast. I was elated. I told everyone to leave me alone for an hour. Amazingly, they did. I grabbed an adult beverage and spent a thoughtful hour listening to your podcast. I love you guys and just wanted to say thank you for an hour of informative, creative, and funny conversation. I needed it. You can always email us. I'm John Williams at WGNradio.com. If you have nice things to say, we'll read them in the podcast. And if you don't, we will take them to heart. That's for sure. Does anybody, though, have a minute on what's going on at Lincoln Park High School? The basketball team took a quote-unquote unauthorized trip to Detroit. Maybe a couple of the kids had sex there. Maybe it was covered up. Maybe the kid that blew the whistle on it has been bullied. Evidently, that student has transferred out of the school. There are now five separate investigations going on to what's happening at Lincoln Park High School, including the fact that administrators have lost their jobs. And then the administrator who took their position, the temporary assistant principal, she decided that it wasn't a good fit for her after video surfaced that in disciplining a student, she grabbed the kid by the face. I suppose we've all seen the video of that. It's harmless.
I don't think it's harmless.
The music that the Sun Times put underneath it is sinister, and I thought. Oh, give me a break. She grabbed the kid by the chin when he pulled away his student ID. Evidently, she was asking for it. There's no volume, but that she touched his chin. A woman reaching out to restrain him touched his chin, to me, is not a fireable offense. I'll let you speak.
I mean, if somebody touched my kid like that?
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay, and I have sons. I don't know. If somebody touched my kid like that, I would have said what? It would not have bothered me an iota.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, we, you know, my husband and I have taught them to sort of be prepared to say, don't touch me. You know, you don't have the right to touch me without my consent. And that's touching without consent. And it's just not okay.
Even in a disciplinary matter like that?
Yes. I teach my girls to use their words. It's harder when you have an authority figure not use their words to convey what they want.
Eric, did you see the video?
I did.
I described it perfectly, by the way.
I did. I mean, the thing is, it's such a small part of this larger story, which is essentially, to me, the issue right now is the mystery behind it. It's that CPS has given really just rough outlines. Our friends at the Sun-Times wrote an editorial just cheering on CPS, saying you did the right thing, you did what you had to do. I don't know how CPS...
Canceling the basketball
season. Well, and let's not forget that...
I don't know how they know that.
This comes as the inspector general for CPS has essentially been fired by the mayor for creating some kind of toxic work environment, and he's supposed to be the one who's policing these sex abuse cases.
Pause and think about that for just a minute. So if we have a situation here, who will look into it? The guy whose job it is to look into it, we just got rid of.
Yeah, the firehouse is on fire.
Exactly.
I was not pleased with how Lightfoot handled that, and I think it's completely inappropriate for a mayor to call on an inspector general to step down, even if there was... We don't know what this was. There are allegations he had, like, a toxic work environment, right? The mayor should not be the one who gets to decide where that IG gets to go or not go. It
Why?
Should be the CPS
because
board.
He might look into her.
Yeah, it's
office
it's,
as
it's
well.
An inappropriate exercise of her authority, in my opinion.
It's the same. It's the same reason that it was inappropriate for Trump to fire James Comey as the director of the FBI. It's like the director of the FBI has a 10-year term. The inspector general has what, 6-year terms,
right.
And they're meant to be independent of that kind of, you know, of politics, and again, we don't know all the details. This guy was apparently kind of a workplace tyrant. But again, just to get back to Lincoln Park, I've talked to parents there, and they are in a lather because they don't know why the basketball season was canceled. They don't know what they really liked this new principal who was let go, the interim principal and the assistant principal and the dean of students. They thought the world of these people. Now, did they make mistakes? Maybe they did. Have they had due process? Who knows? What's the evidence against them? Nobody's saying.
Well, if bullying the whistleblower,
that's created chaos.
Oh, got it. And if bullying, if you can demonstrate that they truly did pester this young kid who thought he was doing right by saying, "Hey, these kids are having inappropriate contact on the field on the basketball trip." If they truly bullied that kid, then that's
the administrators.
Yes,
oh, of course, it's a complete. But
none of us has any evidence.
My
of
mind
that.
Is
they
open to the fact
that
this is completely justified and that they're doing the right thing. But they're not doing the right thing by not communicating to the parents any better. I mean, just today apparently there was some fights or some
there's
little
a big
rock,
fight that
raucous
I saw on
activity
Twitter, yeah.
in the hallways. There, they're still doing
relative
sit-ins.
To this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's all based off this.
The
this
students
stuff.
Had walked out a previous day. Or
yeah,
two.
I think they were doing a sit-in.
I
today.
Believe they did a similar action today
and,
as
and
well.
And it's just like to me, it's just maladministration on the part of CPS not to have a better control. There was a slideshow they gave to the parents on Monday night, basically saying bad things happened. Don't worry about exactly what they were.
Well, they always cite privacy issues, which I presume is again to protect the whistleblower student or maybe the two kids who may have had sex. I don't know, but they've got to find a better way to manage the language about this because it seems to have made it look without any rudder what they did.
Yeah, you did a segment this week on your show.
The coach came in with one of the athletes, and I was shocked that they did. And they, you know, I can only tell you what they said. They were as mystified as we are by why the season was canceled.
And then there's this stuff about, well, it was an unauthorized trip. You know, how does this really? It's unauthorized. They probably had to use school transportation. All the parents had to know about it.
That was a paperwork
staff.
Issue. That was a paperwork issue. The administration knew that they were there.
So trying to get field trips and CPS, just speaking from not my personal experience, but friends who work at CPS, trying to get kids anywhere to do anything is such a pain. You got to fill out so many, which maybe is just, but it's annoying.
They were supposed to go to a tournament in Florida. They found out that wasn't sanctioned. The one in Detroit was. A lot of college scouts are going to be there. They said, let's go to that one. And as the paperwork was shuffling, all of the I's and T's didn't get dotted and crossed. Therefore, it's unauthorized. But it sounds like a rogue thing where the coach said, let's get on the bus and go.
Go, go, go.
And that did not happen.
Duck down, kids.
Who's got the booze?
Exactly. Exactly. Heather, thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
Steve Bertrand had to exit stage left. Austin Berg, always a pleasure to see and read you, my friend.
Thank you.
Eric Zorn, the same. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.